Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 25th, 1998. In the fireside room this evening, we have a forum, and it's about Holden's history. Let's listen in.
I think it's all right for the media ministry to roll the tape. My name is Mark Schwain, and I served the village this summer as one of the two teaching staff coordinators. And tonight we're having a special forum entitled The Way We Were, Stories from Holden's Past. It's special in any number of senses. It's special, first of all, because we're blessed this week with so many folks here in the village who carry with them in their memories a lot of Holden's past. And it's special in that we are not following our normal format, but are going to be rather informal tonight, even more informal than we normally are, in that what we're going to try to do is to elicit stories from folks, which is one kind of contribution, but also another kind of contribution, questions from other folks who've always wondered about something or other that they just want to throw out, hoping that they can find out the answers to some questions that some folks in the room probably know the answer to. So I think what we'll do is, since this might turn out in the long run to be a good resource for Holden histories, kind of an oral history, as memory and history and mythology begin to coalesce in these stories, I'm sure, I think we'll ask people when they speak just to identify themselves with their names. And then I think the first year that they came to Holden Village. And I'm not going to really call on folks. There are a couple folks I have invited to reminisce. And so I'm going to start with a couple of them. But after that, I think we'll just ask you to speak and share a recollection or a story as the spirit moves you. This can be a story about a particular episode. It can be very short, or about kind of a whole epoch in the village's past, a year or a month or a week as you remember it. I'll try to keep things moving along if I need to, but I hope that all I'll have to do is to referee and call on people here. So again, just remember to identify yourselves with your name and the first year you came to Holden Village. And I think we'll start, since she was born, with Carol Nolte. And I think I'll ask the question simply to share with us the most memorable either episode or period that comes to mind and tell us a little bit about it.
I think I'll say something about my first year here, and I hope to get back in the conversation when things get a little bit closer to things that are my experience. I first came to Holden as a result of an advertisement in the old Lutheran Companion that advertised a Stehekin, which was a young adult retreat, the first program that Holden was going to have in the summer of 1962, which if you're in the Pacific Northwest or you pay attention to such things, it was the year of the World's Fair in Seattle. And my family were going to go and visit some relatives in Seattle, and they dropped me off at the ferry in Chelan. And I came up to the Stehekin, and they went in to the World's Fair. And it was, a 10-day program. Umha Wolf was the presenter. Elmer Witt was the chaplain. And it was a wonderful, wonderful program and a very inspiring time. And then one of the things about that is that we also got in on that whole rhythm of work and study. I mean, so that we cleared the road. And the place was a mess. Now, if you think mice are lively in here, mice in those days owned the place. I mean, they sort of sat up and sort of fought you for territory. And I'll tell one story from. I went when the program was over. I went into the World's Fair saw one day of it, saw some big technical display and wrote all over it, Holden is better than this, and I came back and worked the rest of the summer until the day before school started. I was a teacher in Los Angeles, and I went out. But when I came back, I worked with one of the things I did was I sawed logs in what used to be called a two-man saw. What else do you call that?
Cross-cut saw.
Up on the hill, we made a little circle for Vespers up behind Chalet 6 or something like that. And then I also did a lot of clearing and working at getting stuff out of buildings. But we lived in Lodge 2, and there were no lights past 9, I'm quite sure, in those days. And I'll tell you one thing that will never leave my memory, I'm sure, and that is that we carried flashlights with us in the evening, because when you got out of Vespers and got out of doing something down here, the lights would be out, and you had to have a flashlight. When you got back into the lodge, you could see by moonlight outside, but you couldn't see once you got into the lodge. And in the miners' days, they started the numbering of the lodges with 0 and 00. And that's not logical, I don't think. But anyway, so I got back to Lodge 2. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I knew that I was in room 6. So I went down the aisle and I went 2, 4, 5, forgetting that it started with devil's ear. And I walked in and sat down on somebody's stomach. I mean, I thought I was scared more. Incredible. Anyway, I've been coming back not every year, but a lot of years since then, and it's a great place, and it's continues to be better and better.
Did we get her name on the tape?
Yes, I Carol Malti.
Okay.
And the first year was 62.
Okay, I'm Gertrude Lundholm from Rock Island, Illinois, and my husband was teacher of a college in music, and we read it also about the week and the Lutheran Companion. He had done a lot of workshops around the country. We'd been out in New York and Wisconsin, Minnesota, and we read about this place and said, wouldn't that be fun? So we wrote to Wilson Bertrand, who was a U.S. youth director for the LCA church, and said, can you use us? And he wrote back and says, next year, by all means. So we came in 63.
And was I surprised, because I knew her.
And we had no idea what it was like. You know, we got into Chelan and into the Brown Mountains, and we thought, what's this? We thought we were coming to the woods and lake and so forth. It got better and better as we came up. We had 3 children, 2 boys, and they were 13 and 14, and a daughter, 8, with us. And so when we came, they met us in the schoolhouse. That was where the registrar office was, and said, you can have a chalet with a fireplace or hot water. So we had kids, and we thought, you can get warm in hot water, in cold weather, and keep our kids clean. So we chose number 7, and it had hot water in it, bathtub, and the lights went out, as she said, at midnight, I mean at 9 o'clock, and so we used candlelight on the bathtub. And it turned out to be a perfect choice because all the sessions were held in chalets where there was a fireplace. So if you were in one of those, you had to keep your kids quiet. Anyway, we were given that choice, and it was very rainy. It was cold like it is now. And we thought, ooh, this is awful. And we came to Vespers with our blankets around us, and you brought your own linen with you, sleeping bags. We'd been warned of that. So we had all this material, and the chalets were not furnished with much. So we made do with pieces of wood and crate boxes. That was your sitting space. Some of them had beds in and so on. There were some beds in ours, you know, but certainly nothing plush. But it turned out to be a wonderful summer. It was tension, however. They hadn't decided what's this place going to be. So the youth directors had been here. By the time we came, Bergstein had already been told, you know, no longer, you've been in it long enough, no longer a youth director, so we really didn't know anybody. Gilbert was here. He was a businessman who had poured in a lot of money, and he wanted to make kind of a resort place for Seattle people. Mm-hmm. So the rest of the people that were, of the different synods that were represented, had to decide, are we going to have, because the interview, Carol Henley was one of them. He was a youth director for the ALC church. And Bergstein had already gone. Elmer Witt was here. And the youth that came in were from the three synods. So 30 came at a time. So you had 30 kids from LCA or ALC and Missouri. And Carol Lindoy had the idea, we have enough teen camps around this country. We don't need any more. We're going to make this intergenerational. So he decided they're going to come here from birth to 80. I'm even past that. So it turned out that a lot of faculty didn't even show up. I mean, they had kind of a program. Omaha Wolf was here, Merton Struggle was here, but a lot of people didn't even show up. And so they decided, we've got to keep a musician, a scientist, and a theologian here all the time to fill in. If others don't come, we can always fill in programs. This accounts for why I am here this many times. The policy at that time was that nobody comes back here more than 2 years in succession because they wanted to keep it fresh and alive. But we were the core, and so Rudy Edmond was the scientist, and then the person in charge was the theologian, and my husband was a musician. Finally, we got Paul Mott to come here. When he finally agreed to come, my husband says, I've been like John the Baptist. I have talked this place forever. He'd heard Paul Mott at an organist guild in Valparaiso, and he was so thrilled about this man. There were Europeans there. Paul Mott was his idol for that time. So we got them to come up here. Anyway, because of that core, we were the privileged ones who got to stay here. And I just think, I am the wealthiest person here. I've been here all these years because of it. You can't take it away from me. You can't buy it. There's no price I can put on it. My only thing is I share it with all of you, but I still have it. That's the greatest pleasure.
Thank you very much for that. There's a question back here.
Yes, and I think we have people here who can answer it. I'm Ricky Thompson. I was here first year in 79. But there were a group of people chatting last year, I think including Gertrude, I don't know if Carol was there, and they were talking about the year that Werner had the brainstorm. I mean, Werner was just a mainstay of the village for years, but he had this brainstorm of having the carrier pigeons delivering messages from the village down to Lucerne. I don't know all the details, but I know it's very hilarious because I heard them last year. And I was here when the pigeons were up there, but
I don't know the whole story, but that indeed was an effort, and there was a program for training the carrier pigeons. And it was quite remarkable because they would fly around a while and return to the village. The one funny episode that I do remember was the fact that they were taken down and released on a Lucerne, and then were to return here. And one of them made a couple circles in the air and then landed on the hood of the truck and came back up on the but I don't know why the training program was abandoned.
Okay, just so some of you came in late, we'd like you to identify yourselves. That was Larry Rasmussen who spoke on the carrier pigeon experiment. And you first came here what year, Larry?
Well, it was early 70s. I think about 72.
About 72. And now we're going to hear from Dave Christian, who came here what year?
First in 1975.
First in 1975, and you're going to cast light on this carrier pigeon.
On the end of the demise.
David, I just think you should
know. Oh, no, she's here.
Do you want to tell it then?
No, I don't.
Well, correct me where I'm wrong.
Sure, I'll tell the story.
Was this the year after we got married?
Did you eat that?
Elizabeth and I got married in November of 1981, and we came up that December. And stay through the winter, and we had various duties around the village, and one of hers was caring for the carrier pigeons. So they lived in a little A-frame up kind of behind Agape on the road there. Mm-hmm.
And they part all had of, names, didn't they, Libby?
Did they have names?
Yes, they did.
Yes.
Oh, this is getting
do
sadder.
Do you remember what they were?
That's yes. The crux of the problem. I didn't know them by name.
We were sharing this last night. When their house was dedicated,
yes.
Dan Erlander conducted a little blessing in the house.
And America,
he began by saying, "Dearly beloved."
I think we've all grown attached to these pigeons already. So we're interested. What happened to them?
But Elizabeth was in charge of their well-being, and that involved feeding them and making sure that they got proper exercise.
Ooh.
Which meant letting them out to fly, and then they would come back on their own, and then the caretaker was to come and close the door so that other creatures that didn't belong in with the pigeons could get in.
Uh-oh.
So the pigeons went out and they flew, and did it slip your mind, or it got too late? And she went back the next morning.
It was just blah.
And they were all dead. A martin or weasel of some sort had gotten in, and there were little blood marks in the neck. I mean, it was tremendously sad. My wife is now a family practice physician.
I think that the purpose of these pigeons might slip the logic of a lot of people, that obviously we're a little bit more remote up here than most places, and so these were going to be carrier pigeons that could get messages from down lake and up here, and vice versa, the up lake could send down there, and so this was going to be a great benefit to our communications, but it wasn't.
I wanted to add that in the beginning, the water was running in the gutter that's around here, all the way around, ran all the time. And it was wonderful. It gave a great place for the kids to play in. But it was so clear. And I have a picture of Fritz Norstein standing over that gutter and drinking out of it. And I said, I only know one place you can drink out of the gutter, and it's Holden Village. The kids played in it and made boats, and it was a very safe place to play. And when the miners came back here and visited, they said that's what they did too, the children. And it was going all the time.
Where did the water come from, Gertrude?
Well, they had the hydrant turned on at the very top. Oh, and I guess, they didn't worry about water shortage.
It also ran in east down here, but it also ran into the holding, the sewage system, right. So that was a problem.
Hmm. Yes.
Jan Bowman, class of 62. I mean, we were work campers in 62. Jerry and I came on our honeymoon and spent the summer here. You've heard of Honeymoon Heights. You probably don't know that the chalets have also sheltered honeymooners. Shelter is not a good word. Have you ever spent your honeymoon with 100-plus people, getting out on the trail? We were the first to show our environmental sensitivity as a group. And we glazed a trail most of the way up Martin Ridge without consulting Forest Service, of course.
Yeah.
And later it was condemned. But we had a lot of fun doing it. And we wasted a lot of time, I think. And we probably destroyed a lot of the environment in the process. So I like to reflect on the fact that we've at least come quite a ways in terms of our sensitivities. Another project that delighted us was the mine cleanup, which went on for years, but it must have started the year before we came, 61. But we have great fun rolling these huge tires down the slope and watching them bounce. Any kid loves that. One of my tasks was to make a rock garden outside of the village center in that little corner between the stairs to the DC and the pool hall entrance. And I took some of the things I found at the mine, as well as rocks, and worked them in there. I think that was there for a few years. I'm not sure when the 4th of July parade started.
62 we had one.
Well, we had one.
But in 63 we had one.
But it might have started in 61. But I think that was the beginning of Holden Hilarity. It was truly an imaginative and wonderful event.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Is John Campy here?
I think it'd be fun to talk about what things have been really changed since the early days. And one of the things is that there are a number of people in this room that actually have seen the miners' village when all the houses were there. And there were great stories about that. And I know that Drew took all kinds of people out there. We went through those cabins, and we got all kinds of interesting things. But the story was that this was, and partly true, that when the news finally came that the mine was closing, lots of the miners didn't believe it until the day that the last boat was going out. And so they just picked up themselves and left. And they left, you know, the table set and food on the table and all that kind of thing. Well, partly that was true. But it really was fun to go out there. And then finally the Forest Service raised all those homes in 19, help me Gertrude, 64?
63.
End of 63.
63, after the first snow.
63, yeah. And so that's one of the things that's changed, because all you can see is a few foundations left. And also out there, between the trail, where the trail junction goes to either Holden or Hart, right before that, when the trail curves, there was a place where you could go over the edge, and there was a big bridge that was across to Big Creek, which was great huckleberry picking place. The bears also knew about it, but the Forest Service blew that bridge up in about 1964 or 5. And so there was no longer an easy way to get across the Big Creek. And that's too bad. I think they should have left that.
Isn't there still an old shed down there?
There's a Boy Scout cabin as they're called.
There's an old car down there yet, too.
Yeah. Right in that spot?
Well,
no,
near
that's
there.
Up in the miner's
Okay, we have a hand back there. Again, try to remember, identify yourself.
My name is Jean Larson, and I was here in 1962 also. And I can remember going through the miners' village back then, and half-empty bottles of things, clothes in the hampers. But one of the things that I remember was a note on the door to one of the homes, and it said, "If you come in and use our home, please leave it the way you found it, as we plan to return someday."
Oh my goodness. Amazing. So a lot of those people left thinking they'd be back. Very interesting. Yes. Could you identify yourself? Janet?
Yes. I have a question.
Oh.
I wonder if anybody knows any stories about the cabin at Hart Lake. And has anybody been in it? You must have.
Well, that was mine. Yeah.
There's a
Lyman.
Cabin
Lyman.
At
Hartley.
Just at
Falls. Yeah,
say your name.
Oh, Kit Nagel. First time I was up here was 1970. There was clearing out cobwebs here, but there was a cabin there right above the falls on the other side of the creek.
Yeah,
and
it's really cool. We saw it.
There were some people that would come up and frequent it, sometimes hunters and sort of, you know, not the chap, a donkey, but there were people that came up. It was actually very well built, and so a number of us who had wintered over in 74 would go up and hang out in there, and there were still bed springs and things like that. I don't know the status of it now, but you could precariously get across right above the falls on shimmying across logs and stuff. And, it was a pretty silly thing to do, but.
Yeah.
when they decided to build this, I mean, they needed a meeting center, so they had all of us go and get rocks carried out to make this. And it was a fire here in the first place, that's why you see part of it here. And then it became a danger, so they decided we better not hit fire again.
By this, Gertrude is pointing, we should say, to the rock circular fireplace.
Yeah, it was a nice meeting.
Do you remember what year that was? No?
I wasn't here in 65, and when I came back in 66, it was built, so.
Probably then.
The years we have this, is the fireplace. It wasn't just one or two.
No.
Talking about fireplaces, Gene Larson again. My husband and his dad built the fireplace on Chalet number 3 in 1967. Werner Jansen wanted it to be a chalet that could be used year-round. And so my husband had just finished seminary and he wanted to give a gift to the village. And so he convinced his dad to come up here, who was a stonemason, and they built the fireplace then on Chalet number 3.
Then that's the one that eventually caught fire.
No, two burned.
I know one villager has a story, since we're on the 60s, which I think we should stay at for a while. One villager here I know has a story about something scandalous that took place in the 60s, a particular gathering.
My name is John Olson. I was a first year in the village in 1968. Yes, scandalous is certainly a good word. In 1968, I was working at Pacific Lutheran University, and we had a faculty retreat in September here. And we had a brand new president of the university at that time, Dr. Eugene Wigman, who came from the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and he had some different concepts about the use of alcohol. And so, unbeknownst to anyone, including the faculty and Carol Hinderly, who was the director here at Holden at that time, as the faculty and administration came up on the buses, on the back of the bus were cases of champagne. And in this room, on the opening night of the faculty retreat, we had a surprise champagne party to which Dr. Wigman invited Carol Hinderly. Carol Hinderly walked in, looked at the champagne, turned around, and didn't speak to Eugene Wigman for 2.5 years. I think it's probably the only time there was a legitimate, shall we say, champagne alcohol party in this room. Not that Carol didn't necessarily object to the use of alcohol, they just objected to its use publicly, shall we say. So it was a rather scandalous activity in this room in 1968.
Another question on here.
Yes.
I'm Anna Verdell, and it's my first time. What are the baskets? Are those egg baskets that plants are hanging in all over campus? Those cute little black baskets with the little handles?
I think they're for rocks in the mine there.
Were they
not
there?
Janet?
I'm Janet Grant. And the first time I came here was 1980, but I've asked that question also because they use them also up at Stehekin. I noticed them up there and I asked someone. They were the baskets that the men put their clothes in up in the shower building before they went into the mine. And so they had these baskets for their clothing.
Thank you. Well, it's a neat use for them.
Yeah.
I had some stories, at least some descriptions of the mine building. My second year here is 1963, which was Gertrude's first year, Gertrude B. And I worked the whole summer long as an assistant to Rudy Edmond in the mine buildings. And I didn't know a thing about mines, and I sorted stope hole maps, and we took and we tried to label and put in proper order all those core samples and all the stuff that that connected which level they were excavating and with which core samples and that kind of thing. But another part of our job was that we were in the second floor of buildings that no longer exist on the third level. And it was so cold and rainy that year that every day we went to work, we took our own lumber and we had a wood stove up there that we lit a fire and it heated up the room nicely. And then we went through all kinds of correspondence and things that were addressed from the mine out to outside, or things that came in, you know, and we tried to sort through that so that there weren't, there were a lot of damaged copies and stained copies, and we threw those into the fire, and we saved a copy, and it went into the archives. But the best find was one day we were going through telegrams that, and night letters that came up during the mining days, and there was a telegram from a man that had missed the boat, and he was down in Chelan, and he sent his wife a letter and it said, "Missed the damn ferry again."
Yes, John.
I don't know if many of you know, but there are extensive archives on the history of Holden that are not in the village. There is an archivist for the village. Bill Dirks has been that until recently. Ellen Gamrath is our new archivist, right there. Plus, there's an extensive collection, I think, somebody correct me, at the University of Washington.
Yes, right.
And so that there are the records from the mine that are all retained. And so it is available for people who wish to do research on the history of Holden and also on the mine and also on the village.
Well, the archives that we have, I understand, are in an ice chest.
In a freezer. The Holden archives are in a freezer in Bill Dirk's garage.
Right. It's a lockable freezer, however.
It's a lockable freezer.
I'm Bob Quello. First year was 63. We took a group of 70 high school youth from the Twin Cities area out here to clean cabins and finish cutting brush on the trail down or on the road down to the lake at the beginning of the year. If I remember right, I believe we paid $3 a day per person to come out and we worked half day and had afternoons free, and the evenings was when we did our own programming.
Carol Hinderly rode that bus.
And Carol Hinderly had come in for looking at the village the first time and rode out with us, rode back, and made his first stop in Montana to put the tab on somebody for some more money for Holden at that time. But when you were saying that the message was missed the damn ferry again, our relationship with the boat company has not always been as good as it is now. And on more than one occasion, I've been on the ferry watching someone run, at that time it was down the road at 25 mile, to try and come out and just make the turn onto the dock as they said, "Nope, gotta go," and throw the ropes. And away we went. And that was part of, because of a marginal relationship at times with the boat company, that was part of the reason that Holden for a period of time ran its own boat.
Really? What period was that?
Late 60s,
yeah.
It was called the Happy Exchange.
I wrote it.
It had small capacity, though.
Yes. Yeah.
Ellen Gamrath, 63. I'd like to add to that story because I remember one year we were down at the dock waiting to catch the boat. And it was full, and it steamed right by everybody standing there, and nothing to eat, not knowing what was going to happen. Were they going to come back for us? Yep. Did we have to come back to the village? And that happened.
What happened then? I mean,
well, they came back, but we didn't get picked up until.
Well, they sent the speedway.
Yeah, but it was ours.
Yeah. Okay.
Hours, and they're with kids, and they're hungry. So relations have improved since then.
Substantially.
We also came up on flatbed trucks.
Yes.
I mean, that was our first ride up here. No buses.
I'm Jan Quello, and I was in that first group of 70 kids that I was their counselor. I was 3 months older than the kids. We were to be cleaning and doing cleaning the road and things, but we had no equipment. And so we were doing it with our hands.
Oh, God.
Because there was no utensils.
We had found two axes, one hatchet, two cross-cut saws, and I think some hoes. And that's, you know, a couple of garden hoe, and that's what we brushed the road down with. We had nothing that was for really doing that kind of work.
Well, Bertha was the cook here at times.
Yes.
She kept food down in the river to keep it cold, you know, but no refrigeration, really. And she cooked on a little stove that was out behind Shelley's one.
Do you remember, this would have been a pretty important conversation, you said you went out with Carol Hinderly the first time he'd come to look around at the village. Mm-hmm. Did you remember him saying anything about his impressions or ideas or any part of that conversation? That would be an important conversation.
Carol wasn't talking very much about the village at that time. He had decided that I really ought to get off my duff and ask this counselor that is along with us to get married. He kept trying to suggest that that's what we ought to do, and he finally, as he was getting off the bus, said, "My final offer is I'll do the service, no charge, and you can have our cabin on Lake Superior for a week of honeymoon."
And we weren't interested. A few years later.
No, he was starting to, you know, it was not for sure that he was being offered the position. I mean, it was in the process at that time.
Well, there was real tension that first year because Gilbert was here as a businessman, and he put the money into it. Carol hadn't. And Carol came and nobody even welcomed him. Mm-hmm. The bus came up by the dining room and you thought, here's the new director. Nobody went out and said hello. We didn't know who he was either. I mean, the treatment was awful. And it got so tense in the summer. Who runs this place? That Carol and Mary, they left in the middle of it. You know, here we were without a director. Until the board decided, we got to change this.
This was 63 then?
Yeah. Yes.
But it wasn't until the end of the summer of 63 that the board made those changes.
Right.
Nice. Other 60s stories.
I have one, Ellen Gamrath, again, 63, from, I think it would have been the late 60s. All of our supplies come up on the barge, as you know, and we didn't have homemade bread then, and the barge tipped, and all of the bread went into the water. At Vespers, Carol asked if anyone knew how to bake bread. And our kids were little then, preschool and grade school, and they piped up, you know, I knew how to bake bread. I knew how to bake bread for a family of five. So, being a person who takes on tasks that maybe I shouldn't, I said, okay, I'd do it. And so after Vespers, anyone who was willing gathered in the kitchen. And we looked up a recipe for all of these, this large recipe, and began to gather ingredients. And we sang way into the night, and people kept coming in and getting the fresh baked bread, and it was just a wonderful community celebration. Well, at the end of it, this one woman who was helping wonderfully, she came up and she said, you know, I'm the chief baker at a camp, and I do this all the time, and I just want to say to you, you've done a good job.
Carol Nolte again. One of the things that we did for entertainment during the early 60s was that there was a whole bunch of Swiss loggers that were camped down the river a bit, and they would come up on, I don't know whether it was Saturday night or Sunday night, Friday night, I can't remember which night it was, but they would still be dressed in their logging boots even, and we would have polka music in the village center, and they would dance the entire night. There must have been about 10 or so of them, and there was a whole village full of women, and they danced every dance, and it was wonderful fun. We had a great time, and they really livened up the summer.
Say more about that.
But they also took the logs up on wires, and then they sent them down these wires, and it was fascinating.
Because of the steep hillsides here, they were the ones that knew how to log these hills, and so they really, and I think there are several people here that actually went in and learned how to do that with
Mr. Marvel.
Yeah,
we did logging. They also gave the alpine horn.
Yes.
We loved coming up.
They contributed the alpine horn.
Yeah,
the loggers did.
Nice.
Oh, that's where the alpine horn came from. Very interesting. You're mentioning Brattle, and it makes me wonder, some villagers have asked, since they heard this was coming, that they'd like a brief history of the Holden diet. I mean, what did people eat in the 60s, for example? What was the food?
I wasn't here then, so.
What kind of food did you eat in the 60s?
Actually, during board week, it was always very good.
But it still is.
I mean, 3 times a day, you would have something for breakfast, meat for breakfast, lunch, and supper. One year, a Swiss baker who came, and we had fabulous desserts.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
So you would have kitchen staff that would stay the whole summer, the same cook and so forth, and they would have like eggs and bacon and sausage and all that, and so it was meat heavy.
Wow.
They were paid?
One of the things I remember was a big argument about whether it was better to have a good cook or a Christian cook.
I think Luther said it would be better to cook for by a talented Frenchman than a dumb Lutheran. I think that. Yeah, right. Okay, so then when did Holden begin to move down on the food chain? When did that come in?
John Schramm.
Okay, so that started then in the late 70s.
Yes, David.
Let's hear from David.
David Christian is here and has perhaps a thumbnail history for us.
Well, I came in 1975 and was assigned as a volunteer cook in the kitchen and just chopped onions and made coffee and did things I was told. Stan Stevenson was going out at the time. He was trained as a food service operator. I remember every day, I think at lunch there was water and Kool-Aid on the tables, and supper was water and milk on the tables. There were waitresses that did all the shuffling back and forth with seconds.
Yeah.
We had baked desserts most nights.
Yeah.
One of my first tasks was making jelly rolls. I remember we'd make pies for the whole. So that was kind of what was going on. Then Paul Hinderly took over in 1976, Carol's son. And though there wasn't much talk at that time about some of the social and political connections to food, I think Paul actually started some switch with a little less meat. When I came in 1978, or when I returned in 1978 to take over as in the kitchen, John and Mary Schramm took over as directors. So then there was a lot more conversation about how the way we ate had theological, political, social characters to it as well. And we began to talk more at that point about eating lower on the food chain. I would say that during those years, it was rare that I don't think we ever had meat at breakfast. It was rare that we would have it at lunch. Occasionally, maybe some sliced meat for sandwich day or tuna salad. For suppers, I would say we probably had some form of meat 5 days a week, maybe six. you know, we did an Italian night, and that was usually vegetarian. We would do a chef salad night. We did a barbecue night. Sunday dinner was the big...
That was the big one.
Big blowout. We did one seafood night. So it all kind of started that way. Then in the early... And some people that followed me had done more reading and got more into the kind of political social thing, and I think it became more heavily vegetarian than in the early 1980s. Before I came, today we had the, is it Hunger Awareness now or Solidarity? It's gone through various stages. I think it's worth knowing how that started. It was before I came, so it was 73, 74, something like that. There was a group of farmers in southeastern Washington who wanted to support the village, and their best way of doing it was by providing free potatoes. So every fall, the village kept a truck down at 25 Mile Creek, and some staff members would get on the truck and drive down there and come back with, you know, potatoes, which we would store in locker 3. And that was free potatoes for the winter. In 73 or 74, apparently somebody laughed during one of the winter Eucharist services when the offering plate went around, and there was virtually nothing in it because you had volunteer staff who had no money. And there was some conversation about that, and people said, well, what can we do to raise some offering money? And the suggestion was made, well, the potatoes are free. Why don't we one day a week have a potato day, and we'll take the money that we save, since that's free food, we'll take that out of the food budget and put it into the offering. So that became the practice, and for quite a number of years that was a winter only practice, because there was some question about how fair is it to kind of impose that on summer guests. You know, I mean, if you come in and that's your first meal, that can be a little bit of a shock if you've never been.
that and the other part of that discussion was we have workers here during the summer. Yes. The Mavericks will never exist on potatoes alone.
Right. So, I mean, there's been interesting discussion about that. But then at the end of every winter, the community would decide where they wanted that money to be saved and to be sent. And I'm not sure when it went to including the summer as well, late 80s.
Speaking of entertainment, one night we decided to have the Holden Club Soda. And at that time, the staff kids, I mean, we always sang at noon of Hop on the Boat. So we had a kick line that got up and did that. And so at this evening's entertainment, it was in the Village Center, and everybody dressed up, and they had card tables around, I mean, whatever they could find to sit at. And the drinks were just plain, what did we have, cider? Well, whatever, it was Kool-Aid, I guess it was. But anyway, all the fellows got up, wore shorts, and we made net skirts for them, and they were topless. And so it was called the Topless Review. And this would be great to send back to your churches. You what would they think? You know, but it was just tremendous entertainment. And the next day, Carol Hinderly was out in the street, and somebody from the Bible Institute came by, and he said, I certainly didn't sense God's presence. And Carol says, well, if that's your God, I'm glad he's not mine. It was like he was absent from all. You know, how do you dare talk to somebody? But he did.
Yes, Beth.
It was back in about, I think, 73 or 74, and my husband was serving a parish in Ephrata, which is kind of in the heart of the wheat country, and we had been coming up quite often at that period of time, and they were making their own bread, but if I remember correctly, most of it was white. And my husband thought, well, why don't they get some of this wheat from right here in Washington? And so he got several people to donate about 2 or 3 or 4 bushels of wheat. And then we also got people to donate a couple of wheat grinders, and we brought them up. And if I'm not correct, I think that's the first that they ground their own wheat then for bread at Bethany. And I don't know how long those two small wheat grinders were used or when they switched over.
What year would that have been?
Probably 73, 74.
By the time you got here, Dave, were they baking most of their bread and making it whole wheat mostly? 75?
Yeah. I'm not sure that it was the same wheat grinder.
Uh-huh.
But.
Yes. Cliff?
There at the end of the 60s, how many guests and how many staff were coming up? How big was the village?
Does anybody remember 69, 70, how large the village was?
Well, sometimes it was, like over 4th of July weekend, it was really very full. And people would have to, you know, for that weekend especially, they'd have to all bung together and maybe go sleep in the ballpark or something to make a place for, I don't know, 500 guests, or it was incredible. It was more crowded than it is now. There's a lid kept on it now.
Hmm. They asked the staff to do that because they came up and slept in our house and in the basement, you know, wherever they could find room.
So it's not as though the village just steadily increases from the early 60s to now in population. It was actually a period where it was more heavily populated.
But the season didn't even begin until about July 4th. I mean, so that was sort of the peak season. So one or two weeks right in there was very full, and the shoulder part of the season has steadily increased. So that now we have a pretty good sized village even in May. But
one of the first things that happened, I'm talking again, but we didn't have money up here, and so they let a group come up here in those first years. Called Camp Farthest Out. Do any of you know what that is?
Well, Camp Farthest Out?
Yeah, it was started by a Professor McAllister or something, and it was for people who were kind of discontent in their churches. Didn't mean to leave their churches, but they asked if they could use the place. So they came up here and rented, and all we were supposed to do was serve them. So we served the meals, and we were invited to go to their sessions if we wanted to. And you know how we embrace everybody now? Well, they did that at that time, and we'd watch them out of the dining room window, and we called it sloppy agape. Everybody was hugging everybody, and the Lutherans weren't doing that. No way. They also had devotions in motion, and they would be down on the ground doing this kind of thing, getting in tune with the earth. You know, we're getting closer to them all the time. And when they were leaving one time, the director's wife wasn't here. And he was frantic. Well, before they left, they were supposed to write letters to God and save him. And then the next year, they were going to see what happened. And this man was sitting outside, and he was frantically writing. And I just thought he was writing to his wife. And I said, you'll probably get there before it does. And he said, this is my letter to God.
Did God ever mail any letters back? Joel.
Joel Muggy, 1983, I feel like a brand newcomer.
Right.
Come back recently. I really have never heard the story of Chalet 2 who's burning. How and when did that all happen?
I don't remember how it started.
When was it?
It burned in the winter.
It was in the winter.
What?
And only Horty was here and Joe Walmer.
Nobody knows any more than I do. I've heard story that Wes Preeb was living in that chalet along with other people, and he had built a fire up, a street fire, and then went off midday, and when it just started on fire in the chimney, it just got too hot.
And they were all working up on the hill, you know, they didn't realize it until
and
there's
a story that there was a Bible, it was the only thing that was left that didn't
right.
burn.
It didn't
burn. Pages of the Bible, I don't know if that's true or not.
What year was it?
68, I think.
There's one other thing that was very important for the 60s, I think, early, and that is when we first were here, it was required by, officials that we have communion separately. So if we had the LCA were out on the, they went out by the back of Shelley 10. And the ALC was down in the pool hall. Mm-hmm. And the Missouri Synod was at the altar or something. And we found that was so stupid. That's where the barrier started breaking down. And it's been really much more inclusive and open since that time. And the other thing that I think that is significant about this place contribution, there are probably lots, but to the church as a whole that I think has made a difference, is that early on, children communed here, especially faculty kids would be up here maybe all summer. And they'd be sitting in a different place than their parents, and pretty soon they'd be up there and say, "What were you doing up there?" And they were up there because Jesus was there. It was great. So that kind of, I think, influenced the church greatly.
Carol made a statement at that time, really disturbed because we weren't communing together. And he said, "This is just ridiculous." He says, "Not the Lutheran table, it's the Lord's table now. You're all welcome." And from then on, Jewish people came here, other denominations, lots of Catholics. Nuns live with me up in Shelley 7. They feel very comfortable here. Jewish people also.
Maybe not the tables.
Another thing from the early days, fire has always been a danger here.
Right.
But fire alarms would go off and everybody went to the volleyball court.
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes there'd be 4 and 5 of those during a night.
Yeah.
And because the system was not real good at that time. And we've trekked many times during the night.
We had one bad one down behind the village center, and we'd had a late service of about 11 o'clock at night, a healing service, and candles. And different guests said, "Can we sit here a while and visit?" And the alarm went off about 2 a.m, and we all thought they left the candles and the village center is on fire. And we all tore out here, and at that time we had a lot more canned fruit and vegetables than we have today, so there were cans. The hoses wouldn't reach down there, and some of them ended up going in circles instead of reaching down behind, but it was behind the village center. And it burned so high, you just knew that center was on fire, and if it had been wind, the whole village would have gone. Well, anyway, we all helped and ran up here and got tin cans and went down there and passed these buckets of water to finally get it out. And the next day, the forest man and some staff kids stayed there all night and watched it. Said somebody had smoked on that trail. And you could still see the burning logs down there from that terrible fire. It was so frightening.
It was that was a very frightening night. And there was, after the fact, there was some really hilarious stuff, like typically happens in peacetime cops. And when the fire was more or less contained, again, this village was so fortunate because there was absolutely no breeze and no wind, and the cinders went straight up, and they didn't come down. If there had been a wind, it would have taken the valley. But those were the days when there was, in the sewer system, there was a lagoon up on the tailings. And so the cinders were still going up, and some of them were actually blowing over onto the tailings, or settling on the tailings. So a group went over to make sure that, that the fire wouldn't cross over, because, going up in the Copper Basin, it would have died pretty fast. So, the power, and there was no lights up on the tailings, and all you could see was the fire, and it was difficult. So, but they have flashlights. And being very meticulous, there was a sort of like a line of people going out with flashlights, but there weren't enough flashlights to go around. So, two people stood on the old garbage truck and kind of like a searchlight going back and forth like this. And, like three people, I remember this line walking across the tailings, and the beam of light would go across, and there'd be three people, and the beam of light would come back, and there'd be only two.
Oh, my God.
One of the scriptures said one of the problems was it was a difficult place to reach because it's outside of the standard hose lengths for the village. But the hoses got run out and we ran out of hoses. So, well, let's, you know, send the word back out the line, we need more hoses. So Keystone Cop stuff, people started running into the woods with rolls of hoses on their shoulders. And it actually happened at the end of the hose that was connected to the hose house. A guy went running by just with the hose on his shoulder and just disappeared.
This was Kit Nagel's account here. What year was this again?
74, does that sound right?
I think we're all supposed to ask Kit what terrible things he did.
What
destructive activities did he get into as a little kid?
Jet cat.
Oh, well.
Jet cat.
Well, there used to be... there used to be cats and dogs up here, and I won't tell the bad stories, but there was Bernie was a Saint Bernard,
right.
And a huge, lovable, stupid dog. And Saint Bernards are jowly and they drool all over the place. Yeah. And in the winter, this was before the road was the road was kept open. We go over the snow in these track vehicles called Minimus and Maximus. And Bernie would like to go along. And so, you know, they weren't very big, and it was always a struggle keeping this huge salivating mass away from guests and people coming up and down the road. There was another, when there were more than 6 or 10 people coming up that day, there wasn't enough space in Minimus or Maximus to get them. So we hook up the Thiokol, which is a tracked vehicle, but it's a utility vehicle. There's just a cab on it. And the fine engineers at Holden Village created a sled called the Blizzard Wizard. It was a box. And you would stuff as many, OSHA would love this one. You stuff as many people as you could into this box down by, throw a bunch of blankets in it and hope it would make it up.
What did you break?
I broke a few vehicles. it's actually quite interesting that a lot of the vehicles here that are still here are like original to the 60s. And it's almost tragic or emotional in that some of these vehicles have legacies. That people who have worked in this village on staff, have gone to their great reward. And,
the vehicles are still
here. The vehicle is still here. There was a cat up here that's now gone to also its great reward, but called Jet Cat, and it was kind of a cool cat. And in the winter, we used to like to take the cat and go up to the third floor of the Lodge Six and throw it off. And the humorous thing about it was the snow, of course, is very deep, and there was absolutely no noise of the cat going into the snow.
And it would protect that.
Yeah, and so the cat would come down.
And then half an hour later, it was quite up.
Things could get a little slow in the winter.
I have a Bernie story too, and Bernie was this great huge dog. It was really a female dog, so the Bernie was short for Bernadette. But Werner, it was Werner's dog, and he told me this big story that I thought was the greatest leg pull that I'd ever heard, about how there were two strains of St. Bernard, and the one was the famous kind in the movies that came after you with the keg, you know, with the dusty. But Bernadette was from this other strain that covered the body of victims to prevent them from being frozen, and I thought, sure, you know, this is a big lie, and I didn't pay attention. Anyway, I was up here on a sabbatical for one winter, and I was walking this precarious pathway between chalet 4 or something over to the dining hall, and I don't know, I was looking at something, and I stepped off this hard pack and fell immediately 10 feet into this, you know, to this snow. And before I could even, you know, thrill around and try and get out on my own, here's this flying St. Bernard. It covered me.
There's no connection between Jet Cat and those pigeons, is there?
I've heard stories about Bigfoot. Was anybody here when that happened?
With what?
Yeah, they were.
Bigfoot.
Yeah, there were all kinds of stories about whether you saw footprints and that one, I can't remember what year that was. And Saturn used to have great stories about strange animals out there. He was here for.
Judy Jansen was involved somehow.
There was one particular episode that Dale Tester was involved in.
Oh, yeah.
Dale Tester was a very large mechanic. And he was very strong and very athletic. And he loved practical jokes. And this was before I came, this is secondhand, so I may not. This is not historical accuracy. He went into the wood shop and made some footprints.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Great big ones. Great big ones. And he had sufficient gait that even in the snow with these on, he strapped on his feet and he was able to make these footprints at such a distance that you couldn't imagine that a person would do such a thing. And then he went out into the woods, and he had also cultivated the ability to make strange screeching noises. He went out into the woods and just did enough of that it piqued villagers' interest. And nobody, you know, went out that night, but the next morning people saw these and started wondering because there were no human footprints around it. And I don't know how he did the beginning and the end and so forth. But people began to take it seriously. And the story as I got it is that Werner got on the radio and called down to tell somebody that we have a Bigfoot sighting up here in this that you know, we've got the footprints, you better get some scientists up here. And at that point, Dale started getting nervous. So he went and told Werner, so that Werner could cancel the scientists. But then they kept it going for quite a while in the village. I mean, so then Werner and Dale knew, and they just let people have fun with making plaster casts and so forth before they finally let on what it was. But
what year would that have been, do you know?
Yes.
Early 70s.
not long before I came, so 73 in that neighborhood.
That was about the same era that the first hijacked plane and this guy, they found him, he parachuted out with all, and there were all kinds of people that thought, well, maybe we'll find him. It was kind of scary.
Yes.
Are there any good holding ghost stories?
Ghost stories. For many years, we had our own concocted summer story that we would get together and make up. We'd kill somebody, you know.
Oh yeah.
And we'd make up a story about who we wanted to kill and how they would be killed and how it would be discovered and how Wes got into this, whether we killed Wes or what. And that was always fun. That for about 5 years, Ingrid, Chris Johnson was a major contributor to that.
Mm.
We did that several, I mean, that was a good summer novel. But Andy Hindley has written a novel that is about Holden. And I've never read it, have you?
Huh.
But ghosts, no. Not that I know of.
Yes.
I heard a rumor while I was chopping compost that, and I would like to know if it's true, did Wes roll down the hill in that big blue bus up there?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. It went over the bus side. That's the only accident, as far as I know, that's ever occurred.
But Wes was there.
Yes, he was.
It was after 85.
Elmer was the director.
Yeah, Elmer was director.
But it was the yellow bus, not the blue.
Oh. And over the side of which hill?
On the way down.
Kirk is also another one that has been up to a lot of trips here.
Yeah.
Right. He's got some stories.
Kyle.
Oh. You want to offer one, Kirk?
Well, I'm quite hoarse tonight, so I
protection.
We were all in on the celebration of the hydro. You know, they didn't have lights before, and they went out at a certain time, and the three synods, there were top officials that were here when they got it together. We all went out and helped dig the line down, shovel dirt on it, and then they turned the lights on. And it even made a difference in the sound of the organ. You know, there was power all of a sudden. It was just tremendous to have lights on the hydro plant.
In what year?
You used to be able to tell what the weather was going to be because your husband would get up and play tunes.
Yes, you could tell by listening. I remember that.
I'd like to hear what a beautiful day. It's raining, it's boring.
Okay, we'd like to hear, we have a question to hear about the beanie sings. When they started, how long they last, what they were, so on.
Why we didn't do them yesterday?
Yeah. Started with my husband and Doris Edmond. Beanie asked Doris if she would write some words to Place a Park. That was the first song that was written. And it's to the tune that we all know, Day by Day. That's how it began. And then we had a welcoming, we welcomed people at noon with music. And that's when we started to have, we had a song for Holden, H for Holden.
H for I, pleasure.
And everybody was in on that to welcome all the people that came in at noon. More and more of it developed. Different people wrote texts for the crazy words. And my husband's name was Brinoff, and nobody could say it, so they called him Beanie, and that's why they're called Beanie Song. He didn't write the words, but he played the music. And we had him at every meal. And he also played in the morning to wake people up. And the carillons and the organ was given by Wilton Bergstrand, who wrote this book in memory of his parents. And so it was a gift, a blessing of a beautiful new day. So we heard the chimes every morning. We'd wake up to that. And then different people wrote songs.
But Beanie would also come and give commentary on the food on occasion.
Well, they knew about
that. There was... There was one particular, since I worked in the kitchen, whenever there was a Beanie Sing, I was of course there for both settings. So I got to hear the Beanie Sings mm-hmm. twice as much as most people did. And for the most part, they're among my fondest memories, but there was one song that drove me nuts. And it was, "This is our song, come along and join the throng, you can't go wrong. You know, people would, and I just got tired of it. And somehow, and somehow Beanie came to know that I didn't like that song. But Beanie had his own dislikes, and he did not like fish. So, whenever I put fish on the menu, you know what was on the Beanie's menu. And we just kind of played that up over the microphone.
That's great. And there was a Beanie songbook then that was right along with the prayer cards on every table, and then there would be, after a meal, a Beanie song.
There was
a lot
an occasion.
Of people tell me they miss it.
Yeah.
And I say, if it comes from me, it sounds like sour grapes. Stuff the suggestion box if you want to have a Beanie thing.
Yes.
Bring it back.
There was an occasion when, during the time that John and Mary Schramm were here, there was a great deal of concentration on food and our eating. And there was... there was a characteristic about John that not everyone was aware of. And that is that he has a distinct weakness for Fritos.
Yep. Cheese puffs too.
Yeah, cheese puffs will do. But on one occasion, John and Mary had gone out, and as soon as they were coming back into the village, there were lots of stuff that was being carried into their chalets. And one of the volunteer staffers was helping carry these sacks of, it was John's supply. And she looked in, and there was this shriek of, that anyone could hear who was happened to be outside at the time or in any close by buildings. Fritos! He's human!
Yes.
Wasn't there a story about bears coming down to your chalet?
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, the porch of Chalet 7. I live in Chalet 7 all the time. And I served the coffee on Sunday morning so villagers could see who lives in here and so forth. And I had put out apples in the porch and it had just been screened and the bears came at night and ripped the whole thing out. The door was open, but they didn't use the door. Just tore up all the screen. And Joe Bash, no, not Joe Bash, it's a fellow from out east. He's come here many times.
Barge,
he was living with us.
Oh, Bosch.
Bosch.
Paul Bosch.
He got so excited, but he came down and told everybody about the bears in the porch. It was so frightening to him. We were used to it by that time. I mean, they were around, and if you left food in it, that's what happened.
We had a bear in the big kitchen one year.
I remember that.
Larry, weren't you here that summer when we had the big bear problem?
Yes.
And the bear was being sighted several, had been sighted several times, getting closer to the village, people coming out of the sauna at night and running into the bears. So there were, we were all nervous about it. But one of the cooks went in to work one morning, and the back door, it's not there anymore, stuff has been moved around, but the back door, the main door had been left open, as we often did during the summer because it got so hot in there, and just the screen door was closed, and a screen door does not stop a bear. And a bear had come in sometime during the night and had found a 5-gallon bucket of molasses and dipped it over. So there was molasses all over the kitchen floor and bear footprints. Will Mochon was the cook, those of you that know him. And the bear had left by that time, but Will wasn't sure. So his first hour in the building, he was, 4:30 in the morning, he was pretty nervous. But that bear, I think, later met its demise, within a couple weeks because there were just too many sightings in the in the village. And DNR came up and we heard shots. I remember it at dinner one night, and there was just kind of this hush over the village because we felt some sort of corporate responsibility because we didn't treat garbage then the way we do now, and we had kept garbage up there, up by the tailings, and it was a fenced-in area. And that the bears would try and get to, and people went up to try and take pictures. Despite all the announcements that Larry would make,
about staying away. People wanted to get pictures of the bears, and the bears just got more and more used to people, and finally they had to get shot, so.
What year was that?
80, I think.
79 or 80?
80, yeah.
I'll add another, just a short story about bears. You know, the garbage is one problem with bears, but there are other people. People had other theories about why bears would come into the village. And a program director in the early 80s who's on teaching staff here this week, he believed that bears were coming into the village because they could sense human sexual activity. Every morning at breakfast, if there had been a bear in the village, he would announce where it was. And asked us all to refrain from that activity until he...
Well, if Rasmussen was right, Holden's become a kind of monastery ever since. Well, listen, this is the first forum in my years of coming to the village, which was 1979, in which we've actually had a forum go 20 minutes over, and I'm sure we could go for another hour, but I know folks are getting tired and have other plans, and I think it's convinced me to just have a couple more of these during the summer. So I just want to thank everyone for your wonderful stories and for your wonderful questions. And we'll continue this well beyond the time we adjourn, but I just thought we ought to give folks the chance now to leave and get to bed if they want to, and those who want to stay and swap some more stories are free to do that. Thank you all. A couple of announcements. We have a couple of announcements. Yes.
This is a new book that's just been put together just this past week. Wes and Carol the Ranger and myself were brainstorming one. You know, we were doing this just a couple of weeks ago over a cup of tea. And we put together this book called Strange Lights, Odd Events and Unexpected Happenings. Share your funny and not so funny stories. We placed it in here. Wes has written a foreword to it, and we have a few entries. In fact, Wes has the first entry. A few entries, if any of you would like to add to this book. We're hoping that maybe we could get enough written, and with our taping here, maybe we can get something together that we can get into a hardbound or something that we can sell in the bookstore. So if some of you are here and you haven't had a chance to share your story and you'd like to do that, you'll find this out on the table right across the doors here. It's here permanently, okay? Thanks.
Dorothy?
One more piece of history of at 3:45 on Saturday afternoon, Gertrude's going to do a ceiling hike in the village center. Mm. So those of you who are especially newer to the village and wonder what is going on up there with all those wonderful colors, Gertrude's going to...
I don't walk on it.
And Iona's found a book of reminiscences, which Gertrude mentioned.
It's Roses in December, Memories by Wilton E. Bergstrand. And he's got a chapter in here all about when he first came with his wife and two sons. And he even tells about being in the mine, inside the mine.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so if anybody wants to, you can check the book out and read it.
In the Holden Library.
Uh-huh, in the Holden
Before
Library.
Before they blast it off.
Good night, everyone. Okay. Thank you.
We're glad you're here. Oh, we're all looking at you.
Welcome to Hello,
HOLDEM. Hello!
Hello!
Hello.